Ayer vino el diablo aquí. Ayer estuvo el diablo aquí. En este mismo lugar huele a azufre todavía.
He sees Venezuela as the guys who are with me and the guys who aren't with me. And the ones who are against me must leave the country.
It is, he said, impossible to lose. Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez, told a rally he would hold on to power next Sunday and continue with his self-styled socialist revolution.
Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela, is a dominating and polarizing figure in a continent that's famous for large personalities. Politics is played for high stakes in Latin America, and Chavez has beaten coup attempts, strikes, recall petitions, and cancer. Today, Chavez goes to the polls in Venezuela, seeking re-election for a third six-year term. This is Rear Vision on RN and the web. I'm Kathy Gollan, and today, the story of Hugo Chavez and his remarkable journey to the presidency. Everyone has an opinion about Chavez. To his detractors, he's becoming increasingly autocratic, even messianic. For many others, it's either untrue or irrelevant beside the enormous benefits he's brought to the country and their lives. One thing everyone agrees on is that he's different. While all previous presidents came from the same elite class, he didn't.
Well, Hugo Chavez was born in 1954 in Barinas, which is a remote part of Venezuela. He has seven siblings. He was born quite poor in basically a mud hut without running water. He sold lollies before and after school. Chavez's parents were local school teachers. Then, roughly the age, I think, of about 17, he joined the military academy. I mean, his goals in life at the time were to become a baseball player. But he needed to move to Caracas, because Caracas is the capital of Venezuela. And that's where the major teams are. And the only way to actually arrive in Caracas for a boy or teenager from a remote rural part of Venezuela was through the military. That was one of the few options that he had. So he joined the military. And then for the next 20 or so years, he works his way up the military hierarchy.
Rodrigo Acuña from International Studies at Macquarie University. Chavez rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel and along the way became a radical and an admirer of Simón Bolívar, who led the independence struggle against the Spanish. Chavez founded a clandestine group of disaffected officers within the military. They studied the writings of Bolívar and waited for their moment.
During the 1970s, again, if we return to this president, Carlos Andrés Pérez, there was an oil boom. There was some sort of redistribution of the oil wealth in Venezuela. We move to the 1980s, things become quite terrible for many people. And in late 1989, the government accepts an IMF package, basically, and without the ratification of Congress, and basically implements serious austerity measures. This creates a rebellion in Caracas and then eventually spreads throughout the country called the Caracazo. The military is then brought out onto the streets to restore order. We're talking several hundred people, if not into the thousands, were killed during this time. Basically, the entire country is falling apart. And this provides Hugo Chavez and his comrades within the Venezuelan military a catalyst. This is what they were looking for. Chavez has said on many occasions he wanted to do something, but he wasn't clear as to how to go about it. So Chavez organizes a military coup with this underground movement within the military. He fails. His comrades succeed in other parts of the country, but Chavez fails to take Caracas. That was his job. He fails to take Caracas, and then he's informed of the situation, what's happening, and he negotiates with the president and the press to call off the coup, put down their weapons, and they give him 2 or 3 minutes on Venezuelan television. He makes this call, but then he says, I'm sorry, we have actually failed. So he doesn't actually retract from attempting to carry out this coup. And he says, we haven't won for now, por ahora. And, of course, many people in Venezuela, in particular Venezuela's slums, saw that as Chavez was a champion of their causes. This was not a traditional right-wing military coup. This was something different. This is a different political animal.
And he withdrew from politics. He went to jail, and then he was released in the 1990s. And then he decided to run for office democratically with a fairly moderate discourse compared to today's, but definitely in the direction of we have to change the stranglehold of political parties, and we have to, of course, do more for the folks who aren't doing so well.
Javier Corrales, professor of political science at Amherst College in Massachusetts.
And so he became the most popular candidate in that election, and since then he has been the most popular politician in Venezuela.
And so who voted for him in that first election? What sort of people?
People from all walks of life voted there. That it's not easy to predict the vote based on a particular class. Yes, ordinary folks, low-income folks voted for him overwhelmingly, but also across all other income categories. There are studies that show that even well-to-do Venezuelans voted for him. Both the elites as well as the non-elites had many gripes with the status quo and the parties at the time, and they placed their hope on this newcomer, this young person who was seen as somebody who tried the military route, but now look at him, he's trying the democratic route, he can be trusted, he's not that crazy, he's come to his senses and his heart is in the right place. This appealed to lots of people, and he was able to maintain that electoral coalition for a couple of years. Since then, his coalition is very different. He is still in the majority, but he has lost the support of the middle classes in a significant way.
Initially, when Chavez was elected, he cited the British Prime Minister Tony Blair as his role model. And what Chavez was offering was a kind of third way between the market and the state. The issue that Chavez then immediately confronted was the massive power and vested interests of the old two-party regime that he had displaced. We're talking about the private sector organizations, the trade union organizations, which were affiliated to the two parties. So what Chavez faced with his first initial and very moderate attempts to reform the constitution was an enormous backlash from all of these powerful interests which had prevailed in Venezuela since 1958. The challenge that Chavez and Venezuela faced was that the opposition parties themselves had so little credibility. So what they relied on was the private sector media and ultimately the military to act as, effectively, the opposition.
Julia Buxton is Head of International Relations in the Department of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Chavez was elected as president in 1998 with 56% of the vote. Even so, it was never going to be easy for an outsider like him. Newsweek published an article titled, "Is Hugo Chavez Insane?" And the local media was even more hostile. But he could not have predicted that he would face, within a few years, massive strikes, a recall referendum, and a coup, all of which failed. Most significantly, the coup of April 2002.
Venezuela almost entered a pre-Civil War stage with Chavez's supporters becoming more hardcore, demanding that their president became more intransigent, and the opposition getting more scared and demanding that the president would stop going in the direction that he was going. And this produced the biggest street mobilizations in the history of Venezuela. The crisis was so large that a group of military guys took advantage of the showdown between government supporters and the opposition to utilize this crisis and force the president to resign.
In Venezuela, there's been an old-style South American military coup. A ring of tanks has surrounded the presidential palace, and the armed forces have seized power. President Chavez has resigned and is believed to be negotiating his exile to Cuba.
The president wants to be out of the country, I think. He wants to be alive. He wants some guarantee for his life to go out, while there are lots of people in Venezuela want him to go to jail.
Has he resigned?
Yes. His forces, they say that he resigned. but he's still at this time is in the palace, and we don't know yet what negotiations are still going on for him to leave.
One of the shortest coups in Latin American history is over. Only 2 days after he was forced from office, the fiery leftist president of oil-rich Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, is back in control in Caracas, with thousands of his supporters turning out to welcome him home.
What is so interesting is that Chavez returns. In Latin America and throughout the developing world, we get a lot of coups, but we don't get a restoration coup.
After only 2 days.
After exactly, the very same generals who supposedly asked for Chavez to resign were the ones who went back and asked him to return to power. In an alternative scenario, you would have seen power being transferred perhaps to some new person or some vice president or some other figure, but this restoration was very dramatic. It was very a tragic moment in the history of Venezuela. Nobody is proud of what happened that day.
But what the coup plotters failed to take into account was that the lower ranks of the military did not support them. And once word spreads that Hugo Chavez has not actually resigned, that his ministers are being arrested, they're being beaten, and all supporters of the government are being killed, then the military, who did not support the coup, begins to organize. So do Chavez's supporters, and they basically arrive at the presidential palace in their tens of thousands. The military establishes contact with the coup plotters and basically gives them an ultimatum. We're coming to rescue Hugo Chavez in helicopters, and Chavez should be handed back to us. And if not, we're going to have a clash. It was a coup which the opposition, members of the Venezuelan private press, certain sections of the Venezuelan business community supported, but it really did not have support with vast numbers of Venezuelans.
And how did it affect Chavez himself? Did it change the way he, did it radicalize him? Did it change the way he governed?
Well, I think it had two very, very profound effects, not only on Chavez, but on the subsequent direction of his administration. Firstly, it made the government realize that its core support base was amongst the poorest sectors of Venezuela. In 1998, Chavez had benefited from the support of alienated middle class groups. But with the coup attempt, it was clear to Chavez that his core support base was the poor. Therefore, the Chavez government realized that if it was going to survive this immense opposition, it had to consolidate amongst the poor. So as a result of this, we have the development of a series of initiatives called the Misiones, which were social policy projects specifically targeting the poorest sectors of Venezuela. So the government becomes more social democratic, increasingly more left-wing, as it tries to consolidate this social support amongst the poor. The second effect was it made Chavez inherently concerned and paranoid about having potential opponents within his administration or the state. So as a result of this, we have a major purge after the coup attempt of 2002 and the later attempt to halt production at the National Oil Company, a purge of anybody who was seen to be anti-system and the placement of loyalists throughout the state. So as a result of the coup, two factors, a focus on the poor and consolidation of Chavista dominance within the state, both of which became hallmarks of the regime subsequently.
You're with Rear Vision on RN. I'm Kathy Gollan, and we're looking at the life and times of the President of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, who's standing today for re-election. Only a few months after the failed coup of 2002, the country was thrown into chaos again when the managers of the state-owned oil company, PDVSA, walked out. Chavez responded by sacking them all, in their thousands, and replacing them with military personnel and loyalists. Oil production plummeted, but has since recovered, and the company continues to pour money into the state coffers.
Well, the state, first of all, has been able to tap into huge levels of finances. I mean, there's a lot of money that's actually coming into the Venezuelan state, and that money has been used in numerous social projects. I mean, if you're one of the average Venezuelans who lives in, you know, you're part of the 60% of Venezuelans who lives in a slum or in a tough working class neighborhood, you now have access to a local doctor. Big change. You also have access to a local school. Big change. I mean, it's not just health and education. We're talking 250,000 homes have been built. They're building these houses that are called petrocasas. They're made from petrochemicals. I guess we could call them plastic houses. And they've been developed from technology from Germany and from other parts of the world. And the project now is to develop 10 factories and to export these houses throughout the Central America and the Caribbean. So we really are talking about a massive reinvestment into attempting to develop a country which historically, other than the petroleum industry, has lacked a lot of basic infrastructure.
He is the president in Latin America who has enjoyed the most amazing windfall of all times. Venezuela is the most significant petrostate in the world. They now have more proven reserves than Saudi Arabia. It far eclipses any other Latin American country in terms of its oil revenues. And the amount of oil revenues that this government has enjoyed since 2003 has had no historical precedent in Venezuela and in Latin America. And what Chavez has done is he has employed those resources, he has invested those resources, not on infrastructure, not on public management, not on necessarily personal gain or palaces, no. He spends it on what an economist would describe as a typical stimulus package. You know, he just spends and spends and spends and injects money into the economy. So he has created a consumption boom that has produced the best economic times in the history of Venezuela.
In a sense, what's wrong with that?
There are two ways of looking at it. One way of looking at it is that, you know, all governments in the world need to be able to provide economic assistance, and in Venezuela, the need was very, very huge. But the problem is that he hasn't solved the chronic problem that produces poverty in Venezuela, and that is that you don't have a private sector that is able to generate good jobs. So, in fact, what he does is he kills the private sector. He makes the private sector more atrophied. And so, basically, it's kind of like he ruins the engine that should produce the necessary jobs, and then he comes out into the public and say, here's a handout, here's a refrigerator, here's a diploma, here's a clinic, let me give you a subsidy of some sort. This is a terrible problem because the evidence is that Venezuela is an incredibly unproductive society, and the only generation of income is the sale of oil. And unfortunately, oil was not used to reignite the private sector. Instead, it has all gone to providing social assistance. One could also say that one should evaluate these investments in terms of the return on the investment. In other words, for example, that countries like Brazil, with fewer resources, have been able to do much better with poverty alleviation than Venezuela. So there is the question of the return on investments, and that paints a picture of enormous waste.
Very rich people, they are making deals with the government. They're making a lot of money. Very poor people are receiving money from the government. But the middle class is suffering like completely, completely. And every day you see more people in your family, in your friends that are being robbed, dead.
Workers at the station took to the streets to protest against the decision. They waved flags and chanted slogans against the Chavez government.
You're going to be in the streets to make our voices heard. We're going to express our anger and our disgust. They're not going to frighten us, and we are not going to keep quiet.
Just looking at Chavez as a person, why is he so almost viscerally hated by certain sections of the community? What is it about him?
Well, I think Chavez is hated for a variety of reasons, but I would say the two most potent are firstly that Chavez really does represent the threat of a good example. If you are a right-wing economic elite in Latin America, in the United States, the Republican Party in the United States, the last thing you want when you're a supporter of free trade, liberal economics, very liberal and restricted forms of democracy, is an individual who's charismatic and popular and who comes along with radical ideas of social justice, social participation and social equity. So I think Chavez and his actions, whether you like Chavez or you dislike Chavez, is that he has presented a very, very powerful alternative to the dominant narrative of free trade and liberal democracy, which the United States has sought to export across Latin America. An alternative reason why Chavez is perceived with such antagonism within certain sectors is that they view him as being authoritarian, demagogic, totalitarian is even some of the terms we've heard associated with him. Because it's very hard to understand Chavez comes from this humble background, that he has this very kind of common, casual rhetoric with which he addresses people and talks to people. It's a completely different class, culture and ideology. And this is why so many people struggle with Chavez.
Julia Buxton from Bradford University. During Chavez's tenure, poverty has measurably declined. But, according to Human Rights Watch, both media freedom and the judiciary are increasingly coming under pressure. And the limit on presidential terms has been dropped. A two-term limit is the norm in the Americas, but Chavez has decided that should not apply to Venezuela. Twice he went to the people to change the constitution. The second time he succeeded, allowing him to run for a third term this time. Rodrigo Acuña.
Chavez is for many Venezuelans, I mean, almost a saint. And so much has centralized around his personal leadership that it's been very difficult for other politicians within, for other ministers within his government to take prominent roles. And even for himself to allow them to have those, more prominent roles, more visibility. So that's the way he's decided to conduct his affairs. And I would agree with you. It's not a good look. But Chavez would argue that many countries around the world do not have two-term limits, including Australia.
But we don't have a president.
We don't have a president. That's true. I mean, the argument that he would make, again, is that a two-term limit is simply not enough for the project that he needs to carry. He's said on, I think, quite a few occasions that he needs until about 2019, and that's when he's going to step down. You could say that there certainly is a concentration of power around him personally. And that's where Chavez, I think, has run into problems because his administration has constantly been under attack. When accusations are made against particular ministers, he simply just denies everything. And then a few months later, the minister such and such will retire because of family matters, etc., etc. What should take place is he should tackle corruption within his own government as extensively as he has attempted, in many cases has, with the private sector.
I think countries that have had numerous crises, as Venezuela did, are always susceptible to messianic leaders who come out of the blue, are newcomers, promise radical departures from the status quo. Yes, I think not just Venezuela, but countries that seem unable to escape some kind of stagnation, some kind of hole. What wasn't predictable was that once the Messiah would establish himself, that he would be able to consolidate power as much as he did. Especially since he repeats so many of the mistakes of the past, many of the things that he disliked of the previous system, he repeats them. You know, the lack of democracy within his own party, to give you an example. The autocratic way in which decisions are made, the inability to include opposition forces in decision-making. So he repeats these things and he manages to consolidate power. That is the mystery here. The mystery is not so much his rise, but how successful he was to become entrenched in office and have a majority. All along, he has had a majority. He has had followership. And that, I think, it wasn't preordained.
Javier Corrales from Amherst College and co-author of U.S.-Venezuela Relations Since the 1990s. There's details on our website. And the election today? The only certainty is that it'll be closer than in the past. After 14 years, the president is no longer the fresh new alternative. He represents continuity and all that entails, even if it is the continuity of perpetual revolution, as he would put it.
For the first time, there is the probability that he might lose. Many signs point to a probability. Some signs still suggest that he might very well win. But there is enough uncertainty here for reasonable people to imagine that he might lose. If he loses, it will not be by a large margin. So this raises the question of whether he will accept the results voluntarily. Who knows? What is very interesting is that very recently, Chavez, addressing the nation, asked rich people in Venezuela to vote for him. And this is what he said: you have to vote for me because if the opposition wins, there's going to be political instability. And this was an incredibly shocking revelation, because it made people feel that if he loses and if he decides to move to the opposition, that he might bring instability to Venezuela. Incredibly fascinating statement to make. It makes you wonder whether he's a socialist or a reactionary.
I think the most crucial difference is that Chavez is obviously not in good health. We remain very unclear as to what Chavez's health status is and his future prognosis. But what we've not seen in this campaign is the usual intense Chavista popular mobilization. Chavez is not being out and about and shaking hands and embracing people in the popular sectors, which we've seen in previous contests. The other important aspect of this election is it's probably the first time that the opposition have been capable of putting forward a relatively decent and competent candidate in Enrique Capriles Radonsky. But even though Capriles is young, energetic, capable, all these adjectives that have come to be associated with Capriles, the big dilemma is that we still see him being about 10% behind Chavez in the election polls. It's the narrowest race that we've seen in a long time, and it's the most unpredictable election, again, that we've seen in a very long time in Venezuela. So it's hugely unusual. If Chavez wins, the central primary focus of the Chavistas is going to be securing the transition away from Chavez, because there is no way Chavez can remain in power for another 6 years. It's simply not possible.
That was Julia Buxton from the Department of Peace Studies at Bradford University. And our other guests were Rodrigo Acuña, a PhD candidate from International Studies at Macquarie University, and Javier Corrales, Professor of Political Science at Amherst College. The sound engineer is Jenny Parsonage. I'm Cathy Gollan, and thank you for listening to Rear Vision on RN.
Y llegaría hasta allá, hasta el Caño Caribe, hasta la sabana de Alcornocal, y más allá llegaría hasta el río Capanaparo, porque amo esta tierra. ¡Viva el Apure! ¡Viva Venezuela! ¡Viva la patria!